Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show, fresh off a Pentagon update about what the latest is going on with the war. Even though we're at a ceasefire, they have not stopped arming up and getting ready and maintaining equipment. And 6,000 more troops are coming in on the Bush aircraft, which aircraft carrier, which has just made its way. It took the long way around just to make sure there wouldn't be any problems in the Red Sea. So that was pretty clear, as we heard from Pete Hegseth, as we heard from Admiral Cooper, and as we heard from General Kane. This hour, we're going to be joined by Mike Whatley. He wants to be the next senator from North Carolina. Before we get to Mike, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I don't think that the message of the gospel is meant to be abused in the way that some people are doing. And I will continue to speak out loudly against war, looking to promote peace.
Right. Pope Leo, not backing down, neither is the President of the United States. Pope first, the President, the clash not going away. Why the facts might be on the President's side.
Number two.
I'm perfectly happy to have people change the world, you know, and do amazing stuff and be rich. They have to be good members of this community and pay their taxes. And I'm a billionaire who wants them to pay much more taxes.
That is Tom Steyer. Not popular with Democrats or Republicans, but one of the only ones left in California to be governor. So the race has been shaken to the core, thanks mostly to Katie Porter's being repulsive and the fact that Eric Swalwell might be looking at prison time. This would finish off the state if he actually wins. Matt Mahan, Steve Hilton might be the answer.
Number one.
Our troops are highly motivated, they're focused, they're vigilant, and they're ready. And they're using this time to do a couple of things. We're rearming, we're retooling, and we're adjusting our tactics, techniques, and procedures. There's no military in the world that adjusts like we do, and that's exactly what we're doing right now.
And that is Admiral Bradley Cooper in charge of the operations in Iran, ready to fight. Trump sending more troops and yet ready to talk as the blockade in the strait is squeezing Iran in every way, shape, and form. Probably should have been done right away, but it certainly was an act of brilliance over the weekend to put it into place. It totally reversed things and flipped the script. Mike Whatley used to be by President Trump's side almost every day and running the RNC. He is now working hard in North Carolina to be the next senator there and hold on to that seat that Tom Tillis has currently. Mike, welcome back.
It's good to be back with you, Brian.
What's it like being on the stump?
I love it. It's a chance to get out there and talk to every community around North Carolina. We got 100 counties. We've been to 80 of them already. And, you know, what you get to see is the best of the best.
Mm-hmm. And has the Tillis campaign helped you at all or not really?
Well, look, I mean, our conversation is going to be with the people of North Carolina. We're going to talk to every family. We're talking to every community. We're getting out there, you know, whether it's rural North Carolina, we got mountains, we got beaches, we got cities, we got a bit of everything, kind of a microcosm of the country.
Right.
And, you know, it really is great to talk to everybody about the issues they care about. They want to talk about the economy. They need more jobs. They need better jobs. They need to take home more money. They need lower taxes so they can keep more money. And we need to have, you know, safe kids and communities. That's the issue sets we're putting on the table.
And for the longest time, he's one of the things you could hang your hat on was gas prices. But with this conflict in Iran, that's not the case. Has that made your message harder to deliver?
Look, I mean, this is a temporary hit that we know is going to go back down. And it's also less now per gallon than it was with Joe Biden in office. And that was without a war. So, you know, the fact is gas prices are too high. Thank God that President Trump has unleashed American energy. We're producing more oil than any other country in the world, because otherwise these shocks would be dramatically higher. And we are still lower than they were under Biden's administration.
So money wise, where do you stand?
Well, look, I mean, we're raising money. We raised more than any other Republican in the country during the last quarter. We will have enough money to get our message out and make sure that we're there. Is Roy Cooper going to raise a ton of money? Sure. You know, Kamala Harris outraised President Trump by over $1 billion. Fact is, in North Carolina, good politics is defined by good policy. And the fact is that we are pushing an agenda that the North Carolina voters want. They want more jobs. They want better jobs. They want more pay. They want lower taxes. They want safe kids and safe communities. That's the issue set we're running on and we're putting on the table.
So you're running against a Democratic governor in what I think is a red state who won twice. So what's your challenge?
Well, our challenge is just to make sure that people know who Michael Whatley is, and we're going out there and we're having those
name
conversations.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a huge deal. But, you know, the thing is, President Trump carried North Carolina three times in a row because he promised to rebuild our economy, restore our borders, and keep our community safe, and to make sure that we're going to have the strongest country and the most respected country around the world. That's the issue set that North Carolina voters voted on three times for him. Roy Cooper's a card-carrying member of the woke mob. He is out there pushing every single day for higher taxes. He's pushing every single day, you know, for a woke, weak America. And he also is a guy that released over 3,500 hardened criminals out of North Carolina prisons because he didn't want them to get COVID. He's the guy that you know, signed up to bring pretrial release and cashless bail to put those criminals back on the streets. And he vetoed legislation to get violent criminal illegal aliens out of North Carolina by forcing sheriffs to honor ICE detainers, right? He's going to fight harder for illegal aliens and criminals than he is the people of North Carolina. I'm going to fight for every community and every family.
What about the battle you're having right now, just being coming into a midterm election where a sitting president and a party did quite well in the last election, a lot of it thanks to you and Laura Trump. Mm-hmm. So the history would be against a big a red wave that pushes back on a blue wave, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But the fact is, we're going to win this cycle because the people of America want a strong economy. They want a strong country, and they want to know that we're going to be safe in our homes and our communities. That's what the Republican agenda is. I mean, take a look yesterday, tax day, right? You know, the fact is that with the passage of the One Big Beautiful Bill and the extension of Trump's middle class tax cuts, the average American family took home $3,400 more money because they didn't have to pay those in taxes. In North Carolina, average family, $5,600 less in taxes than they would have had to pay if that bill didn't get done. My opponent, Roy Cooper, made it very clear when he announced his campaign that he would have voted against the One Big Beautiful Bill. He also vetoed six different tax cuts as governor, and he voted to raise taxes when he was a legislator.
So when you look at what's happening now, you see you're in a city right now run by a socialist, a proud socialist. And then you have a election today on a Thursday. I know it's bizarre for Mikey Sherrill became governor, opening up the 11th congressional district seat. A moderate is running this guy, Joe Hathaway, very impressive guy. He's running against an extreme leftist who is going to be the left even of the squad. This will be a card-carrying member of the squad and proud of it. And Aliyah Mejia running against Israel, $25 minimum wage, running against all aid being cut off there. And, of course, abolishing ICE and has come out and abolishing the police in the past. What does it tell you about the Democratic Party that candidates like this have won primaries?
Yeah, look, the Democratic Party is absolutely off the charts left. They're moving further left every single day. They're
Except
moving away
Fetterman.
From mainstream. Yeah, I mean, Fetterman is really, truly the one example right now of somebody who is trying to be rational and have those conversations. But, you know, you think about what the Democrats ran on in 2024, open borders, inflationary spending, a weak, woke America. And that's exactly what they're doubling down on right now. They're doubling down on stupid. The president won. We won a House. We won the Senate because we were fighting for the issues that the American people care about. Right now, that is where the Democratic Party is, and Roy Cooper fits right into that narrative in North Carolina.
So North Carolina is known as part of the, would you say, part of the Bible Belt?
Well, absolutely, yeah.
So when you see the president, which is not unusual, Reagan had a problem with Pope John Paul II and a few things when it came to Persian missiles in Europe. You had George W. Bush had a problem with stem cells and the Pope at the time. And then President Trump was attacked by the previous Pope because of his stand on immigration. And now the president's going at it with the Pope, as was the vice president now. Does that make your job harder?
No, look, I mean, the fact is the president and the Pope both want peace. The president wants to end this war in Iran. It's not even a war, right? The president wants to end these actions in Iran, and he wants to make sure that we don't have nuclear weapon capacity from that country, that they don't have missile capacity to deliver payloads into Europe or the United States. When the Pope says that he wants to see peace, that's exactly what the president's fighting for.
So here is what the president said yesterday, cut 33.
We don't like a pope that's going to say that it's okay to have a nuclear weapon. We don't want a pope that says crime is okay in our cities. I don't like it. I'm not a big fan of Pope Leo. He's a very liberal person, and he's a man that doesn't believe in stopping crime. He's a man that doesn't think that we should be toying with a country that wants a nuclear weapon so they can blow up the world. I'm not a fan of Pope Leo.
Would you... So pretty much what you said about the president, but then Pope Leo weighed in about an hour ago again with statements pushing back against war. He was against the Venezuelan operation too. Does he not see what TDA has done to our country? Has he not seen what happened at the border? Has he not seen what Maduro has done to his country? Has he not seen some of the positive things that happened since?
Yeah, well, the president is making the world safer. You know, when America is strong, the world is safer. And when America is weak, the world's a far more dangerous place. What happened down in Venezuela was, you know, we took out the most dangerous man in the Western Hemisphere. You know, what's happening right now in Iran is the fact that we are making sure that they cannot develop and deliver nuclear payloads into Europe or the United States of America, and they're not going to be able to export terrorism around the world. That is the world being a safer place and a better place.
When you look at what's happening right now with renewing the FISA warrants, right now the Republican Party is not giving the president the renewal he thinks he needs. People like Congresswoman Boebert is not on board, and you know that Rand Paul, people like that, are never on board. Where do you stand?
Look, there's a lot of conversations that need to be taking place. The fact is the federal government was weaponized under Joe Biden. They went after Donald Trump. They went after his allies. That cannot happen
ever
again.
But he's the one who was victimizing, yet he's saying renew it.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that people want to put up appropriate guardrails, and that's a conversation that is appropriate to have.
All right. Thanks so much, Mike. If people want to support you and your quest to become the senator of North Carolina, what do they do?
Yeah, go to the website, michaelwadley.com, or they can follow me on X at WadleyNC.
Do you have a debate? Do you guys have a debate agreed upon yet?
Not yet. You know, and I certainly want to have that conversation with him all day, every day about the differences that we have, because, you know, I want to make sure that we have a strong economy. I want to make sure that we have more and better jobs in North Carolina, that people are paying less taxes. I want to make sure we have safe kids and communities. I want to make sure that our men and women in uniform have what they need to protect our interests and allies around the world. Roy Cooper is 180 degrees on every single one of those issues. He's a card-carrying member of the woke mob, and he's going to represent New York, California, and Illinois, not North Carolina values.
Will the president be campaigning with you?
Yes, absolutely. We've had a number of good conversations. He's already been to North Carolina twice since we launched. We've had Vice President Vance down there a couple different times. It's a state that the president carried three different times, and he's definitely going to be a very strong ally for us.
Mike Whiteley, best of luck. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Brian.
All right, we're back in a moment. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This blockade applies to all ships, regardless of nationality, heading into or from Iranian ports. The U.S. action is a blockade of Iran's ports and coastline, not a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. Enforcement will occur inside Iran's territorial seas and in international waters.
That is Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane, short time ago addressing the updated situation with the military. Just because we're in a ceasefire, they have not stopped. Also telling the rules of the blockade that it went to effect 10 o'clock Eastern time on Monday morning. Admiral Cooper made an appearance for the first time in the Pentagon briefer. Here's what he had to say about what we're doing. Cut two.
Our troops are highly motivated. They're focused. They're vigilant and they're ready. And they're using this time to do a couple of things. We're rearming, we're retooling, and we're adjusting our tactics, techniques, and procedures. There's no military in the world that adjusts like we do, and that's exactly what we're doing right now during the ceasefire.
And that is pretty interesting. Right now, oil is about $90-something dollars a barrel. We want to keep it under 100. We want to get it down to where it was, about $65, $70. That's not going to happen until there is some type of an agreement. And now we think they might be agreeing to meet again, but we know the ceasefire is up by Tuesday. But as usual, the Iranians will say, hey, we want to meet. We just can't get to it till next week. They want to string this out. And they think more economic pain would mean more pressure on us. But not really. You have about a month's worth of oil left and your whole country stops because you're not allowed to get them out. We're cracking down on the ghost ships. There's between 500 and 700 ships just stuck outside the strait, can't get in and can't get out. So we'll see who blinks first. We're ready to go. And the president of the United States, even though he's optimistic that something will happen, there's no guarantee. And he knows that, too. The thing that has somewhat surprised me is there's so many things the president's doing at once. Like, for example, today he's going out to Reno, Nevada to talk about the tax, no tax on tips. He's going to talk about the economy. He used to talk about gas and oil prices, but he says for now they're down. What has caught me by surprise is how Pope Leo, who I know nothing about from America, who's basically sounding more like a Chicago resident who happens to be the Pope rather than a Pope representing a billion or so Catholics. Here he is this morning continuing to be critical of the President of the United States. I mean, what he just said, again, saying he's not a fan of the war, not liking the fact that where this is heading, that we don't do things, for example, in a war. They say we don't do things like we just care about the war. We don't look at the damage that's left behind. I think he's 100% wrong. Have you heard of the Marshall Plan? Did you see all we did to rebuild Iraq? You see all we did to try and rebuild Afghanistan? It cost us a ton of money. And believe me, it was nothing short of controversial. Here's some of the things the Pope's saying, continuing to go at the President of the United States. Cut 35.
I don't think that the message of the gospel is meant to be abused in the way that some people are doing. And I will continue to speak out loudly against war, looking to promote peace, promoting dialogue and multilateral relationships among the states to look for just solutions to problems. Too many people are suffering in the world today. Too many innocent people are being killed. And I think someone has to stand up and say there's a better way.
Yeah, there's too many people being killed. What about the 40,000 people that were killed in cold blood by the Iranians? Now, it would be different if you said, I'm outraged by that, and you said it at the time in January. But now you're saying, well, because we had to take the battle to them, we're the aggressors. Donald Trump's the aggressor. Even Maduro, one of the most despicable characters in our hemisphere, take it out, send TDA here to kill us and wreak havoc in America. The fentanyl and cocaine that's come through, the fact that they've spread communism all over the world. I think the Pope used to be against communism, but didn't really speak up on that. So he thinks that he has a right to speak out. You could do whatever you want. That's a good thing about being the Pope. Speak out whenever you want. But don't be surprised with this president anyway when he comes back at you. And here he is, said this on Truth Social. Will someone please tell Pope Leo that Iran has killed 42,000 innocent, completely unarmed protesters in the last 2 months? And for Iran to have a nuclear bomb is absolutely unacceptable. How about that? Meanwhile, the Pope continues to be critical. He described the war as an absurd and inhuman. He called for an immediate de-escalation and an off-ramp to peace for peace. Good luck with that. Now, the President of the United States taking a risk. He got a lot of Catholics here. He got the Catholic vote by about 10 points. I think he's just got to explain his position and don't make it personal. But the Pope is doubling and tripling down, which makes me think that he is a flat-out ideologue. That's why we have a separation between church and state. And that's why some people, it's hard for us to believe, were hesitant to elect a Catholic because they thought the Catholic, like John F. Kennedy, would be answering to the Pope, not to us.
That makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Our forces are continuing to strike Hezbollah. Concurrently, we are conducting negotiations with Lebanon. These negotiations have not taken place for over 40 years. There are two central goals. First, the disarming of Hezbollah. And second, a sustainable peace.
That's a goal, but they're meeting with Lebanon today, and they had a meeting earlier this week, so it was brokered by Secretary of State Marco Rubio. And joining us now is Ofer Falk. He is a foreign policy advisor to the Prime Minister Netanyahu. Welcome, Mr. Falk. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me.
First off, have you stopped to a degree hitting Hezbollah or leveled off? Because the president said to kind of not knock it off, but kind of low-key it?
Well, again, we're complete partners with the United States and obviously President Trump with war, in war and in peace. We're complete partners. And in terms of Lebanon, we're hitting Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a genocidal terrorist organization. And if we learned anything from the October 7th atrocities, is that we cannot allow a genocidal terrorist organization anywhere near our border. We are implementing that lesson as we speak right now. As for future negotiations and ongoing negotiations with Lebanon, we have two main goals. One is to dismantle Hezbollah. That's a mutual goal for both Lebanon and for Israel. And two, we hope to forge a true peace, real peace, peace through strength with Lebanon, as we did with President Trump on four different peace agreements, brokered with President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu.
So pretty amazing. On October 8th, the story came out that you guys, when realizing we're heading towards a ceasefire, you took massive action to the point where they said what you guys did on April 8th was more devastating to Hezbollah than even the pager and walkie-talkie attacks. 50 aircraft hit 100-plus Hezbollah targets in a very short period of time, taking out hundreds of Hezbollah fighters. What was the reason for the blitz? Is because you knew the ceasefire was coming?
It was a pre-planned operation, and you're right, Brian. It was the biggest operation we've done since the pager operation, where we took out hundreds of Hezbollah terrorists then, and now we also took out hundreds of Hezbollah terrorists. It was pre-planned, and that's what brought them to their knees. That's what's bringing them to their knees.
Dr. Ophir Falk is our guest, and he comes to us from Israel, advisor to the prime minister on foreign policy, which is basically we're focused on. What is left of that organization, do you think, in terms of missiles, in terms of personnel?
Well, Hezbollah, again, we degraded it significantly. We've taken out, they had about 150,000 missiles targeted at Israel. We've degraded that immensely. We've taken out almost 2,000 terrorists since February, since they launched attacks at us again. And we've taken out about 6,000 since 2023. They've been degraded significantly. And that is what has enabled direct negotiations with Lebanon. Because you need to understand, we had a ceasefire. We had a ceasefire with Lebanon November 24th. What did that ceasefire say? The ceasefire said that the Lebanese government needed to dismantle Hezbollah and demilitarize southern Lebanon. That did not happen. That did not happen because they either lacked the will or the ability. Now that Hezbollah has been degraded significantly, hopefully the Lebanese government can step up to the plate and do the right thing. Because up until now, Lebanon has been held hostage by Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a proxy of Iran. They were sponsored and funded by Iran for years. And it's just an additional wing of Iran, which has been shouting or chanting death to America, death to Israel for 47 years. And we're putting that to an end. We're putting that to an end in Iran and in Lebanon.
So let's focus on Iran for a second. For the most part, in terms of the individual leaders, your intelligence has allowed you to take out, would you say, what are the number of political and military leaders you've taken out since this operation began?
Well, we took out scores of leaders, of regime leaders, and nuclear bomb scientists, both in Operation Rising Lion in June, that we did the Midnight Hammer operation with the United States, and again now in a Roaring Lion operation. We've taken out scores of their first-tier leadership, the regime's first-tier leadership. We've taken out a large part of their commanders and their second-tier leadership. Now they have a D-League, more or less, leadership that needs to be dealt with. At the end of the day, our objective in this operation was to make sure they have no nuclear capability, to degrade or to reduce their ballistic missile capability, and to create the conditions for the Iranian people to do the right thing. We have had enormous achievements along with side by side, wing by wing, with the United States. We've had enormous achievements. We've brought them down to their knees. We've taken out thousands of missiles. We've taken out hundreds of launchers. We've taken out a large part of the regime's leadership and commanders. We've hit their economy, the regime's economy, like never before. They've lost something like $250 billion. And today the world sees that this genocidal regime is trying to hold the world or to blackmail the world with the Straits of Hormuz, with the oil. You could only imagine what they would do if they had the bomb. If they had a nuclear bomb, they would hold the world blackmail, and there would be very little that we could do about that. So President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu did the right thing, and they're saving the world.
I think so. Are you surprised that this regime hasn't fallen yet?
They've been hit very, very, very hard, and I think they will fall. But again, that's up to the Iranian people to do the right thing, for the Iranian people to take, you know, to stand up to the plate and to do the right thing. For that to happen, I think that opening the internet, which has been closed for 45 days, is almost as important as opening up the straits.
How can you do that? Is there a plan in place to do just that, opening up the internet?
Well, again, right now, there's negotiations. It's a turning point. I wouldn't say it's the end of the war, but I would say it's a turning point. And if Iran gives up the material, reduces the ballistic missiles, stops sponsoring terrorism, their proxies all over the world, Hezbollah, Hamas, and other places as well, in South America as well, and if they stop slaughtering civilians like they did just a few months ago when they slaughtered over 40,000 civilians, if they stop doing that, the war can end. But again, give up the material, ballistic missiles, stop sponsoring terrorism, and stop slaughtering civilians. The rest, the Iranian people will do.
Well, do you think that this regime, what's left of it, is going to be more moderate or more militant?
It's hard to say. What I can say is that they've been degraded significantly. They have very little power left. I think that their neighbors, they've been bullies for 47 years in the region. They've bullied the entire region, their neighbors, the entire Middle East. And now those bullies have been hit back. They've been hit by their neighbors as well, by the UAE, who stepped up to the plate and have done incredible things. So what we saw for 47 years, we're not going to see anymore. And the president said enough is enough. The prime minister said enough is enough. And I actually think we have a great future ahead. Again, it could either go the easy way. The easy way, as the president said, if they adhere to those four demands made to them by the president, or it'll have to be done the hard way. But they will not have nuclear capabilities. Iran will not have nuclear capabilities. That's essential for the future of the world.
And lastly, Dr. Ophir Falk, our guest from Israel, advisor to President Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu. After the last series of talks, it came out that the Iranians in that room could not make the final decision on any deal. And that has to be zero enrichment, no ballistic missiles, no funding of the proxies, let alone opening up the strait. And then it became clear to J.D. Vance and his crew, these guys couldn't make the decision. Who can? Who is still alive? They can make that decision.
I think they have a lot of gaps and struggles within their organization, within the regime. At the end of the day, they will need to make the decision to give up those things, or as the president said, we'll have to make up that decision. We'll make that decision. But one thing is for sure, Iran cannot have nuclear bombs and cannot hold the world hostage anymore.
There already is heavy equipment moving through, clearing up some of the missile sites. Does that concern you?
Pardon me, say that again?
There's heavy equipment moving, trying to unearth the missile sites. Does that concern you?
Well, we are watching very, very closely. We're watching very closely. And if they make another mistake, it might be their last.
Dr. Ophir Falk, thanks so much for your time. I know you got a busy day. And as always, we'll see if the ceasefire continues or not, but you're ready for anything. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you very much.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. Back with your calls in just a moment. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The headlines, the stories behind them, and the people who make them. Only on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I can't stand our government. We have a president who I consider to be a criminal. I have a president who is a criminal to us and who's a criminal to people all over the world. So when I say that the head of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, is a criminal who is bad for the people of the world and bad for the people of Israel, that doesn't mean I hate Israel. It means their government is doing something that is wrong and he's breaking the law, and we shouldn't be supporting that.
That is Tom Steyer, a billionaire with no friends, who wants to be the next governor. And suddenly, it's not a far-reaching possibility because Eric Swalwell is in the middle of a scandal. He's going to be lucky to stay out of prison. And then you have Katie Porter has been exposed as an insufferable lunatic, so she's unelectable. And then you have Steve Hilton, who's still leading or co-leading the polls as a Republican. And the question is Sheriff Bianchi going to be able to excel and get to the point where he's second and will both Republicans be in the race? There's going to be panic on the left. Is Tom Steyer the best answer for that? I mean, I hope not. I mean, you guys got to have higher standards than that. It is finished. This guy's a green maniac. If you think you're paying high prices now for oil, which got to be imported to the tune of 30% from the Middle East, where the rest of the country, we get like 5%. Here's more from Tom Steyer. Listen to him on environmental justice, cut 23.
California has had structural racism in where we put our toxicity forever. And that's roads, that's dirty plants. Environmental justice has got to be part of every plan, and people from those communities have to be leaders in devising those plans to make sure that we directly address what has been structural racism in our society forever.
Right. That's what we need. More people talking about how America sucks. Structural racism. Only an environmental maniac who thinks it's 2019 would believe that. Thankfully, as a country, and even if we look at the way in the Europeans, they're realizing that. You know who's getting more oil and gas and building coal plants like crazy? China. Well, realizing they could sell us all the environmental equipment and green energy that we want while getting rid of nuclear at the same time. So Tom Steyer is moving to the front of the polls. My hope is that Steve Hilton wins. But if a Republican, if a Democrat has to win, you would think it would be a guy like Matt Mahan. No, Matt Mahan is somebody that they say is moderate. San Jose politics is not first on my agenda every morning, but that's how he's governed. He's got this Silicon Valley money. I mean, literally millions upon millions of dollars. But I think the most he's ever gotten in the polls is 4%, mainly because most people know who Eric Swalwell was, and he was on top of the polls. But for the most part, if you look at Mahan, he has raised California. He's got his California version of a super PAC. He's raised $12 million on that. It comes up to a total of about $27 million overall. And still, he's unknown in California, where he's been, I think, a two-term mayor so far. So I just don't. I don't get it. I mean, and you have Gavin Newsom, who's basically just trying to run for president, who's done just a terrible job, and he got a terrible mayor. You know, you think that the people of California would go, look, I got a businessman, very successful, Rick Caruso, but you went with Mayor Bass. She's been awful, disappearing during the fires, not rebuilding still. That's why Spencer Bratt, the actor, got into the fray. Listen to him on Joe Rogan, cut 27.
What I need is all of Los Angeles to be a Nick Shirley. I, as mayor, am going to offer cash bounties. If you film any fraud, city workers doing something suspicious, any type of scams, and you bring it to the mayor's office and we check it out, I'm going to pay you.
But, you know, instead they're doing an anti-Nick Shirley piece of legislation that it's not unfathomable to think that it could get passed. You know what it is? It makes it illegal, a $50,000 fine and possibly prison time, if you go up and interview people about fraud or anything else, like what Nick Shirley did in Minneapolis, what he did in California with the hospice scandal. I mean, it's just be off the charts. There's something like 200 hospices in a 10-square-mile radius, and none of them had any people in it. So when people like Nick Shirley go and find out about it, this legislation would actually allow him to be arrested. I mean, that's how crazy it is in California. I mean, they are finished if this guy Tom Steyer wins or if Steve Hilton doesn't. And this Mayor Bass, why would anyone elect her again? But I think it's emblematic of what's happening in places like Illinois and across the country. In New York in particular, you got a mayor here who is bragging about raising taxes on the rich again. Same thing as a governor who swore no new taxes. It's the cover of the New York Post. They want to put anybody with a house, a second home over $5 million, you're going to pay more. Why? If you can afford to keep a $5 million home empty, you can afford to pay more. What kind of logic is that in a capitalistic society? Instead of having someone invest there, grow there, improve their house here, go to Home Depot, hire workers, painters, landscapers. Instead, you tax them more. They turn around and go, I'm not staying. I'll buy a place in Texas. I'll go to North Carolina. I'll go to Tennessee. I'll go to Florida. That'll be my second home. I don't need to stay in New York. I mean, most people stay in New York for the most part because they have to be for work. But it's usually very, you know, if you want to have a place to stay when you get to New York City, now people say, listen, I didn't get rich for no reason by being stupid. And that would be stupid. In terms of California, I'm very curious to see what the next polls show and who they're going to get behind, because right now Nancy Pelosi was behind Eric Swalwell. Senator Adam Schiff, which is hard to say, is behind Eric Swalwell. Gavin Newsom, not behind anyone, but actually condemned Swalwell and all this behavior that's been exposed. I think there's also a sub-story there. One of the stories is, how much did you know about this guy, and how much did you get away with? Did you let him get away with? And still, you got to tell me, Nancy Pelosi, with all her resources and all her people and all her experience, who basically made sure Eric Swalwell won his congressional race, are you going to tell me right now that you knew nothing about him? Here's how scary Steyer would be. Here's Amy Robbins talking about who he would be if he got in charge. Cut 31.
What are these Democrats doing? It's like they're having blue state demolition derbies to see who can wreck their own people the fastest. I mean, the thing I find really interesting about Tom Steyer's platform to abolish ICE and jail their agents and then also give free range to all these criminal illegal immigrants is that he was benefiting at the same time from one of California's largest immigration detention centers. So if that is not hypocrisy on steroids, I don't know what is.
And also on top of that, he wants to get rid of private prisons while he's investing in that. Crazy times. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. Find out how to see me in Reno, Nevada, coming up on May 30th.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, from Midtown Manhattan, Brian Kilmeade here, coming your way. And of course, we got a YouTube channel now, so if you can't see the show or listen to the show live or you want the highlights, go to youtube.com/@TheBrianKilmeade Show. You can also listen to us live on your app, but hopefully you're in our family of affiliates, could continue to listen there. This hour, we're going to be joined by Mark Thiessen and Josh Krasauer, Inside Politics and Inside the Latest on the Iran War. A short time ago, the Pentagon had a briefing where we heard from Pete Hegseth, Secretary of War. We heard from the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Kane, and Admiral Cooper for the first time. He's the one whose strategy is being implemented from CENTCOM over in Tampa. He was over in the Middle East and let us know that things are, just because we're in a ceasefire doesn't mean anything has stopped. I'll give you the details in a moment, but let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I don't think that the message of the gospel is meant to be abused in the way that some people are doing. And I will continue to speak out loudly against war, looking to promote peace.
Can you believe this? Pope Leo, again, doubling and tripling down against the president, who I don't know if you heard, does not back off. Pope first, the president will have the latest.
Number two.
I'm perfectly happy to have people change the world, you know, and do amazing stuff and be rich. They have to be good members of this community and pay their taxes. And I'm a billionaire who wants them to pay much more taxes.
Good, Tom Steyer. California governor's race shaking to the core as lefty billionaire Tom Steyer might just be among the front runners. This could finish off the state, in my view. Steve Hilton and perhaps the so-called moderate Democrat Matt Mahan could emerge. We will see.
Number one.
Our troops are highly motivated. They're focused. They're vigilant and they're ready. And they're using this time to do a couple of things. We're rearming, we're retooling, and we're adjusting our tactics, techniques, and procedures. There's no military in the world that adjusts like we do, and that's exactly what we're doing right now.
Ready to fight. Trump sending more troops and yet ready to talk as the blockade on the strait is squeezing Iran dry and now saying that we're going to stop people from getting close to Iran, let alone in international waters. I think it's a pretty great move, and it's been a brilliant move. And in the beginning, we heard Democrats say, I don't know what he's trying to do here. They couldn't figure it out. Senator Warner on Sunday, when they decided on Monday at 10 a.m. it would go into effect. One guy that figured it out all along and thinks it's a great idea is Mark Thiessen, former speechwriter. He's AEI fellow and Fox News contributor, Washington Post columnist. Mark, you think this was a good move from the get-go, correct? And man, is it, as in your view, has it been as effective as you thought it would?
It's a spectacular move. I mean, if you think about this, a week ago, all of Trump's critics were saying the Iranians have trumped him. They've leveraged the Strait of Hormuz to force him to the negotiating table, to force him into a ceasefire. And they're winning the strategic victory in the war. What a difference a week makes, man. The Iranian economy is being absolutely crippled by this blockade. Trump has used the ceasefire to bring ships, military ships through the Strait of Hormuz into the Persian Gulf, which the Iranians now can't fire on because of the ceasefire. And we're enforcing a blockade that is absolutely crippling their economy. 96% of all Iranian trade goes through the Persian Gulf. Their land trade has been devastated by the war, and so they're more and more reliant on the Gulf. And on top of that, it's going to eventually, in a few weeks' time, it's going to absolutely destroy their oil production, which is going to implode because they have nowhere to put the stored oil. They're running out of the land storage capacity. So they're putting it on tankers that are sitting in the Gulf. But eventually, that capacity will be filled, and then they have to shut down their oil production, which damages the oil production. You can't just turn off. It's not like a water tap where you can just turn it off. If you stop the flow of oil, it starts to damage your capacity to do it. So they're heading for an existential financial crisis. And on top of that, they import a lot of gasoline. They don't have the refining capacity, so they're actually short. They're going to have gas lines. And the irony is that the Iranians helped cause a gas lines in America in the 70s, and now this blockade is going to do it to them.
So they say to rebuild, it's going to cost the Iranian state, if there's no other war, $270 billion. This is to a country that's going through the pain of 180% inflation. Prior to the war, it was 40%+ inflation, and they had a worthless currency and no water in their capital. So now you would think by listening to most of the coverage that we're the ones taking the pounding, not Iran. So Mark, and I this is one of the most, it must be baffling to people that don't do this on a daily basis like we're lucky enough to be doing, because you would think that this has been a negative campaign when you watch the brilliance of our military. And then during the pause, we've just added 6,000 more troops and another aircraft carrier, the George H.W. Bush.
Yeah. I mean, look, the Iranians, right now what we're doing is we are using this leverage to pressure the Iranians to give up their nuclear, what Trump calls the nuclear dust. And if we can use this leverage to get them to give that up, allow the United States to do what we did in Libya in 2003, which when Libya agreed to give up its nuclear program and its ballistic missiles, U.S. aircraft landed in Libya, loaded up all the centrifuges, loaded up all the plans for bombs, loaded up all of the materials, and flew it all to Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And it's still sitting there to this day, the Libyan nuclear program. We destroyed their ballistic missiles on the ground and supervised their destruction. If we can do that, that will be even the New York Times will have to acknowledge that that's a victory that Donald Trump achieved.
I would think so. I want you to hear Chris Van Hollen and Ambassador Michael Waltz. Cut eight.
You don't think it's a violation of international law to blow up a bunch of civilian infrastructure because the government of Iran refused to open the Strait of Hormuz? You don't think that would be a violation?
I think President Trump, the American
people. Do you think
people,
that would be a violation of international law?
I think they expect to use every bit of leverage that he
I'm
has.
Asking you if
you have military units using bridges
to go down to the Straits of Hormuz to attack international shipping and launch missiles into resorts and airports and ports across the strait.
So,
and that's absolutely a
so
valid
Mr. Ambassador, essentially what
And
you're
I got to tell you, as a veteran who had to pull these triggers,
Mr.
I think the president's absolutely
Mr.
in the
Ambassador.
Right.
So they don't even know who they're messing with. And this just shows you. And I'm watching Chuck Schumer just says that they just came out, if I could just paraphrase, Iran is making the mother lord of the Strait of Hormuz right now. No, they're not. He's going off last week's notes.
It's crazy. I mean, look, this is where Donald Trump here has completely flipped the script on all of his critics and on Iran. So if you think about this, a week ago, Iranian ships were going through the Strait of Hormuz, but no U.S. or allied ships were allowed to go through, right? Now the opposite is true. Now everybody's ships are allowed to go through the Strait of Hormuz except Iran's ships. I mean, the complete jujitsu move that has flipped the whole narrative in the Gulf, and they can't keep up with it. This is one of the most brilliant moves any president has made in a war in recent memory, and they can't survive it. The economy will implode if they don't capitulate. So, you know, let them all sow their narratives. The reality will catch up with the American people, and everyone will see what a brilliant move this was.
The main Iran's main benefactor has been China. Yesterday, the president of the United States says China has agreed not to send weapons into Iran. The president said Wednesday that China has agreed not to do this and are very happy of the U.S. efforts to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. The meeting is on target for May. Do you think the president should go through with that meeting?
It depends on what the situation on the ground is in Iran. Hopefully by the time the summit comes around, this whole thing will be done, and Iran will have capitulated and we will have won. I mean, look, there's a deadline coming on Tuesday. First of all, the other thing that Donald Trump has done is, so China gets almost all of its oil through the Strait of Hormuz, and it's getting a lot of it through Iran. And now that oil is not coming through, which China's not happy about. And so Trump's answer is, tell your friends in Iran to capitulate. Tell them to stop blocking the strait. You know, if they open up the strait and they give us the nuclear dust, then this will all end and everything will go through. So, you know, he's leveraging China against Iran. And then, you know, the deadline is coming on Tuesday, the 2-week deadline. The Iranians obviously will want to extend it. I don't think Trump should extend it. I think he should give them a deadline of Tuesday. And if they don't capitulate on the nuclear dust, then the bombing continues. We've destroyed about, you know, very depending on what it is, about 80 to 90% of their capacity. But that 10 to 20% is still important. And Admiral Cooper has about 10-14 days left of strikes to carry out. We should, if Iran won't capitulate, we should just finish the job and we can go get the nuclear dust ourselves against their will, because once we destroy all that stuff, they won't have very much capacity to deal with us.
Would you meet again, and who would you send?
Well, it depends on what they're willing to do. You know, I would not send anybody until there is an understanding. Well, I think, first of all, I think Trump is talking to the Iranians directly now. He's leading the negotiations.
That's how he lost his voice, by the way. He was screaming at
Yeah. Him. Exactly.
I'm being serious.
So, you know, I think the only way we send anybody again is to accept their surrender, you know, in all but name. That we negotiate the deal beforehand, and then we go and accept it, and we accept it. But if they're not willing to let us go in and collect the nuclear material, the fissile material, then there's no point in meeting.
So I want to bring you to the Pope and the President. So the Pope again called out the president today in a speech in Algeria, and basically says that this war is a war of choice. He was against the Venezuela operation. He's against their immigration policy. So I don't love the pictures the president's publishing, but I don't mind the president pushing back. And I'm stunned that Pope Leo thinks it's to his benefit to take on the president like he's a Chicago pundit. What about you?
Yeah, so I mean, I... I look at the Pope and I think, well, of course the Pope is going to call for peace. That's what popes do, right? He's not a military strategist. He's not an intelligence officer. He doesn't get intelligence briefings the way the president does. There's a lot that Leo doesn't know. And so what he's talking about is Catholic teaching on a preferential option for peace. And I wish the president wouldn't lash out at him. He's the Pope. It puts Catholics in an uncomfortable position. But on the other hand, I will tell you that the president is right to be offended at the approach the Catholic Church has taken to him. You've got the three amigos, the bishops of Washington, Chicago, and Newark, who are doing interviews with 60 Minutes, attacking his immigration policy, yep, attacking him on the war and all the rest of it. You know, where were these guys during the Biden administration? You had a Catholic president, okay? So Donald Trump isn't a Catholic.
Who's pro-abortion.
He's got no particular responsibility to follow Catholic teaching at that. You had a Catholic president who ran on a platform of abortion on demand up until the moment of birth, paid for by the American taxpayer. That is in Catholic teaching, that's what's called a scandal, right? Where people look at that and they say, well, the Catholic president can believe that, I can too. And these cardinals were silent. They said nothing. And all of a sudden, Donald Trump comes in, the president who gave us the Supreme Court that overturned Roe v. Wade, which was a Catholic objective for decades. And all of a sudden, they found their voice under Donald Trump. Where were your videos condemning Joe Biden? Where were your 60 Minutes interviews together condemning Joe Biden? That was your responsibility because he was your guy. He was a Catholic president. And you said nothing. So I find the hypocrisy of the American Catholic bishops to be stunning. And I say this as it pains me as a Catholic. Not all of them are like this, but they've allowed themselves to become a tool against Donald Trump, and it's a disgrace.
No one knows more about recent political history than you, but Ronald Reagan was called out by Pope John Paul for his putting intermediate range missiles into Europe. We know that George W. Bush was called out by his stance on stem cell research. We also know that Bill Clinton was called out for being pro-choice by different popes. Okay, that's their prerogative to go and do that. But this pope, the last one in 2016, was on Donald Trump for wanting to have a border and looking to stop illegal immigration. Listen to this pope on immigration, cut 37.
I know that in Europe there are many times fears that are present, but oftentimes generated by people who are against immigration and trying to keep out people who may be from another country, another religion, another race. Stories, testimony, witnesses that we heard even in the past 2 days of people helping each other, Christians with Muslims. I think those are lessons that would be important also that we heard in Europe or North America, that we should perhaps be a little less fearful.
Does he really not know the difference between immigration and illegal immigration?
Yeah, and the Catholic Church has certainly fallen a long way from the Crusades.
Yeah, I would say.
The Battle of Lepanto, where we turned back the Islamic hordes that were coming to conquer Europe, it was carried out by the Pope. There's a long history here when you've got a 2,000-year-old institution that you might want to have some consistency with.
And how about consistency in World War II, when they knew about 6 million Jews? Paperwork reveals that Pope Pius the 100th, or whatever it was, knew about 6 million Jews being annihilated, didn't do anything about it.
Yeah. So see, here's the thing. Catholic teaching does not require you to have open borders. And Catholic teaching does not teach that there is no such thing as just war. What is an appropriate border policy? What defines a just war? These are things that are what are called in the Catholic Church matters of prudential judgment, right? That reasonable Catholics can disagree over what those policies should be. Abortion, on the other hand, is not a matter of prudential judgment. The Catholic Church teaches it is an intrinsic evil at all times. So you had a Catholic president who was openly supporting what the Catholic Church teaches as an intrinsic evil, and the bishops and the cardinals were silent. And now you have a matter of prudential judgment where we can disagree. Where, I mean, the Pope is not competent to decide whether or not the war in Iran is a just war because he doesn't understand intelligence. He doesn't get the same briefings. Right. Those are matters for state authorities. He can provide moral guidance about it, but he can't declare it a just or unjust war, nor neither can a cardinal. Yet they're speaking out on all these matters of prudential judgment where we're free to disagree. And they had nothing to say about a Catholic president who was engaged in intrinsic evil.
Mark Thiessen,
you know, hypocrisy.
Thanks so much. Back in a moment.
Big guests, bold opinions, better information. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. It's really stunning news. And this just in, Fairfax County police say former Lieutenant Governor of Virginia, Justin Fairfax, shot and killed his wife, Serena, before killing himself. All that happened overnight at their home in Annandale, Virginia. Chief Keith Davis says is on the scene, made the announcement. This is part of a messy divorce. You kid, that's an understatement of a lifetime. They got kids, and one of them called 911 afterwards. So we're following that story and see where that goes. But it looks like there's some finality to it, sadly. A big tragedy over in Virginia. So we'll keep you up to date on what's happening. When we come back, Josh Krashauer on everything political, what's happening in Washington, including maybe the Senate is now in play on the Republican side. I'll find out if that indeed is true. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I say abolish ICE now! You can't reform that! It's not fixable! Get it out! Kick it over!
I stand by the fact that I've called Benjamin Netanyahu a war criminal. We don't need armed thugs running around our streets shooting American people just for exercising their First Amendment rights.
This is some of the crazy things this woman said with the $25 minimum wage, abolish ICE, abolish the police, too. And, of course, Israel is a terrorist organization. That is Analia Mejia, and she is looking to, right now, she is in the polls leading up to today's special election. She's leading the Republican, so-called moderate, although he seems kind of conservative, but he's portraying himself as a moderate, Mikey Sherrill's seat now that she has become governor of New Jersey. Josh Krashauer joins us now. Josh, she gets in another member of the squad.
Yeah, this is an even more unusual race than the other squad races because the district is a very wealthy, kind of moderate-minded district in New Jersey. And as we've learned, all the energy right now in the Democratic Party is with the socialists, with the extremists, with the Mamdani's, the Graham Platners of the world. And Mejia won the primary in a very capitalistic district because of the Democratic faction, that is the socialist-minded faction. And now, given how partisan everyone is in a pretty in a lean Democratic district, she's going to be the favorite to be heading to Congress in that New Jersey seat. So this is what we're going to be seeing a lot more of this. We've seen this with Mamdani last year. We're seeing this in a lot of primaries. We're seeing very far left candidates like Al Sayed. We've talked about him in Michigan, Platner in Maine. I mean, these people almost make socialists seem moderate in terms of their views and extremism on some key issues. So this is just, I think, a preview of what we're going to be seeing in some of these Democratic primaries in the coming months.
I mean, look at this guy, Hassan Piker, who Al Sayed has been on the stage with, and they don't disavow each other. I mean, this guy is as racist and radical as he gets. One of the great things, worst things that happened in the previous century is the fall of the Soviet Union. Vladimir Putin didn't write that copy. He believes it, too. And listen to this, cut 46.
I hate Republicans. I oppose them. I say that all the time. I think that the Republicans are far more damaging. The biggest terrorists, the biggest domestic terrorists in this country, the biggest terrorists internationally is the Republican Party. And not only that, but it's just like I want to fight against the growing fascist movement in this country.
So he hates Republicans. He also said Rick Scott should be killed. And then we have Ro Khanna go, well, I want people of all different thought processes. I want to talk to find out about what they think. I have no problem appearing with them. Are you worried that this is going to be mainstream accepted?
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's put things into perspective, Brian. He's calling Republicans terrorists, but pointedly will not call Hamas and Hezbollah U.S. designated terrorist groups that have killed many, many Jews, many Americans, committed some of the most heinous terrorist attacks in my lifetime. He will not call them terrorists, right? He thinks America, he said on his stream, America deserved 9/11. I mean, this guy is off the chart. He just visited Cuba and has praised. You talked about the recent comments he made at Yale University. He basically praised every communist and totalitarian regime in the world, including Cuba, including Soviet Union.
In fact, listen to this. Here, yeah. Cut 47.
I've also said I'm a harm reduction voter. I'm a lesser evil voter, and therefore I would vote for Hamas over Israel every single time because I'm looking at the situation as a paramilitary organization that has like a political party as well, a Politburo as well, that is entirely comprised not as an alien force, but of orphaned children that have, you know, had their parents killed by an apartheid state that has been dominating the lives of Palestinians for 80 years at this point, and they've done a genocide at this point as well. But I think that Hamas's tactics, which I oppose at times, right, or it's like internal governance issues, are secondary to this conversation.
Really, just internal governance issues? I mean, yep. Think about that.
I mean, their charter, their internal governance says we want to kill all the Jews. That is directly from Hamas's charter. So, I mean, you can, you know, take what he says at face value. This guy is excusing and has excused some of the most heinous, crimes and slaughter in recent memory. It really is stunning. And it, you know, you would think this guy would be totally beyond the bounds of a respectable Democratic Party conversation, but increasingly he's going on Pod Save America. You have other candidates like El Sayed, who's a leading candidate now for Michigan Senate. He's competing against two other Democrats for the Senate nomination, and he's in contention in that primary. You have Graham Platner, another big story we broke at Jewish Insider yesterday. Graham Platner, who was leading the Democratic primary over the state's governor, Janet Mills, was liking videos of Hamas terrorism, where Hamas killed Israeli soldiers, and he was in real time praising that and saying he digs it. And this is, again, a Senate candidate running against Susan Collins, running against Janet Mills in the Maine Senate race, and could be a senator from the state of Maine. In the Democratic primary running right now. I mean, the stuff that was so beyond the pale in our politics and in just polite discourse that is now being normalized and mainstreamed and no one in the Democratic Party seems to be speaking up against these pro-terrorism sentiments. I mean, it doesn't portend anything good for the party or for our politics.
Well, I would say not. Mondami's perfectly fine. He's intrigued by Piker. He wants to learn more. And Ro Khanna, who fancies himself a presidential candidate, listen to this exchange on Meet the Press, cut 49.
I do want to ask you, here we are in the midst of the midterms. You're someone who's been quite outspoken. You have made several appearances on a show hosted by socialist commentator Hassan Piker. Some of your fellow Democrats, though, have raised alarms about his views. Here are two members of a left-leaning think tank. This is how they put it. They wrote, quote, no left-wing agitator is more influential and extreme than Twitch streamer Hassan Piker. He's referred to ultra-Orthodox Jews as inbred, employed anti-Semitic dog whistles, bloodthirsty, violent pig dog against an anti-Hamas viewer of his stream, compared liberal Zionists to liberal Nazis, and said Hamas is 1,000 times better than the Israeli state. Now, Hassan Piker says some of his comments have been taken out of context, but he largely stands by them. Do you have any regrets about appearing on his show?
None, and I would go again.
So that should be disqualifying. Not that he's ever going to be president, but what do you think about that, Josh?
Well, it's telling that you have people. Some people will say, oh, well, it's okay to go on someone's show. But not only are they saying that they're going to go on the show, but they're not saying that they're going to condemn and speak up for sanity on the show. Like, if you're going to go on the show, you might as well speak out against the pro-violence, pro-terrorism, extremism that's regularly being advocated on that show. But they're not even saying that, right? I mean, so this is just a profound kind of a collapse in morality of standards. I think it's a really big warning of where the Democrats – I mean, I think the Democrats are feeling very confident heading into the midterms. And look, midterms are essentially referendums on the incumbent party, and I think there is a desire for a check and balance, and that's helping the Democrats, even though their own party image is in pretty bad shape. But I think Democrats feel confident about at least retaking the House and maybe even the Senate. But the reality is, when you have a presidential election, when people actually look at two different candidates and where the parties are going, this is the kind of baggage that's going to tar the party over the long term. I mean, maybe things have changed dramatically in my lifetime in politics, but excusing 9/11 or defending Hamas, I still think those are so out of left field that would be just absolutely toxic in a general election.
So here, Cory Booker and Ruben Gallego refused to engage with him. As you mentioned, Abdul El-Sayed invited Piker to campaign rallies. And then Zohran Mamdani appeared on Piker's stream and later distanced himself from specific controversial remarks. But he, yesterday, Mamdani's making news by celebrating raising taxes and saying that, look, Governor Hochul wants to raise taxes too now. Well, what is your take on this big push among Democrats to make the wealthy or the successful vilified? The wealth tax, now they want to tax people who have second homes in New York.
Well, I think if you look closely at some of these candidates and who they are and where they come from, Mamdani is a creature of the Democratic Socialists of America. He was endorsed and affiliated with them before he ran for mayor. And they hold virulently extreme positions on Israel, but they also believe in, essentially redistributing the wealth. I mean, if you look at their platform, look at what they believe in, and this is not any surprise. Obviously, it's a lot of what Mamdani talked about at times on the campaign trail. And he's not the only one. There's a sort of a Mamdani effect where Democrats are like, well, if this guy can win in New York City, maybe we should try this in other parts of the country. So, Plattner is someone who has at least been enamored by the socialist and left-wing elements of that movement. El-Sayed, the same thing. These are when you kind of dig, look a little bit under the surface, and you can see that the Democratic Socialists of America, which I think many of them are more communist than socialist, if you look at the actual platform that they espouse. But these are actually they're being immersed into the Democratic Party infrastructure. They're being tolerated as part of the Big Tent in an effort to, I guess, appeal to just disaffected voters. This stuff has never worked in general election politics. It usually is a turnoff to most swing voters, and I think that will remain the case over the long haul. But it is remarkable how many candidates, and in my hometown of D.C., one of the leading mayoral candidates is endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America. You're seeing these folks pop. These are not just your garden variety liberals or even very progressive socialists like Bernie Sanders. These are people, if you look at their platform, are adopting a platform of extremism that, reminds you of kind of the Stalinists of the 60s that kind of were holding on to the supporting the Soviet Union and a whole lot of other radical positions back in the day. This is not Bernie Sanders. This is old school Bernie Sanders. It's even beyond that. So I think, it's not just Mamdani. The fact that Mamdani was able to win that Democratic primary was a lesson for some of these candidates. And you're seeing them coming out of the woodworks in House races and Senate races across the country.
Lastly, on the governor's race over in California, what changes now? Swalwell was up at top. Steve Hilton was right there. Now they're pushing Tom Steyer, but he's got no friends. I mean, he's got no constituency up until now. Or do you give him a real shot?
Well, he has money, and that in a field where you don't have any Democrats that are catching fire, the money is making a difference. Not many people like Tom Steyer. Even Gavin Newsom didn't say anything nice about him in an interview I saw yesterday. But no one likes Katie Porter, who's the other polling leader right now for the Democrats. She's I think everyone knows what her baggage is. She abuses her staff, and she's very far left in terms of her economic policies as well. So, and Newsom, I think, is worried about someone even to the left of him taking over the governorship and leaving that legacy or having that legacy in place as he runs for president. So, look, there are a few. I mean, the interesting thing is there are a few people that are pulling kind of back in the field on the Democratic side, like an Antonio Villaraigosa, who's the former mayor of L.A., or Matt Mahan, who's actually a pretty moderate mayor of San Jose. But again, to our point that we've been talking about, the Democrats want social. They want far leftists. They don't want the moderate candidates. They don't want the people who have shown that they can govern right now. They want people who are pretty radical. And I think Steyer certainly has funded a whole host of pretty leftist causes, and Porter is on the very left wing of her own party. So those are the two leading candidates right now, if you believe the polling in the Democratic field.
Josh Krashauer, thanks so much. Big day.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. We come back. I'll tell you what's happened in the war. Big press conference an hour ago and what it means for maybe getting those gas prices down. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Our troops are highly motivated, they're focused, they're vigilant, and they're ready. And they're using this time to do a couple of things. We're rearming. We're retooling and we're adjusting our tactics, techniques, and procedures. There's no military in the world that adjusts like we do, and that's exactly what we're doing right now during the ceasefire.
And that's what people are asking, what's that going on? And Admiral Brad Cooper made an appearance today at a CENTCOM. He came up to Washington. Donald Trump has talked about this, General Kane, and I think the blockade has been a game changer. I love that the minesweeper destroyer went into the strait during the talks over the weekend, and then they announced at 10 o'clock Monday, there'll be a lockdown, shutdown, blockade, and it's worked. They've had 10 ships come through. All 10 have been rejected. They've knocked off anyone in international waters, turned them around or shut them down, as well as any of the waters near Iran. What it means is within a month or two, they're going to run thoroughly out of oil because they got nowhere to put it. They got nowhere to refine it. They almost have no refineries at all. So therefore, they have to refine it outside their borders. They can't sell it. They get no more revenue. They've got their steel blown up. Their petrochemical plants were blown up during this operation. Man, things are looking bleak for a country that now is 180% inflation. But you would never know it from listening to the press. Will there be an extension of the ceasefire? What about the price of oil? When's it coming down? Scott Bessent was asked about that. Cut five.
I think we're going to have to wait and see when they are permanently open, because this is a mechanism. When we declare that it is safe, they also have to have insurance. Lloyd's of London had skyrocketing insurance during the time. The rates are still very high. So we want to provide, the U.S. government will make a profit on this, but we want to provide a more normalized level and an economically sound basis for ships to move in and out of the Gulf as they did before the start of the conflict.
Yeah, so when they do that, then things are going to drop down. If you look at some of the numbers, though, people say, oh, my goodness, well, gas is at $90 a barrel. How long can we take this? Well, if you look at past administrations, this administration knows, everybody knows that they want to drill. So that's why the price per oil, for oil is down. But if you look at compared to previous administrations, you look at Barack Obama's, for example, when he was in office over the course of two terms, on average, an average barrel, $83 a barrel. The second term, I should say, the first term was 83. The second term was 70. First term of Trump, $52 a barrel. Biden went up to 80, 79.20 to be exact. Second term for Trump is still lower at 65. But you just wait. When this thing comes to an end, and I think it's going to be a satisfactory end, you will see it drop again to 55. And I love the fact that Democrats are saying, we're going to run on the price of oil. Okay, you do that. And when it changes, keep running on the price of oil. You'll realize the same people that said, we're going to make MAGA a negative word. President ran the word MAGA, that acronym, back to the White House. James, you're in Florida. What's on your mind?
And Brian.
What's on your mind, James? Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this portrait of Trump being portrayed as Jesus being healing somebody. I remember vividly when Obama was running for president that he was portrayed as the Messiah, but no one's talking about that. What say you? And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Well, look, I personally think the president is always been a little different, unorthodox. I don't mind him going back at the Pope, still respectfully. I could do without the pictures. I don't think it's that insulting or blasphemous. Some people do. But I think that when you have the Pope who came, nobody argues this. The Pope came at the president twice, first in January in immigration, just the previous Pope went at him in 2016. And then they went at him again about the Venezuelan operation. And then finally on Iran, the president said, that's it. All bets are off. I'm taking on this Pope. He would never be Pope. I don't know if that's true or not. If I wasn't president. So this Pope goes out of his way to comment on what this president has done. Now, could he have actually got some support from the president by bringing up eight separate times that he brought peace to a region, including in Gaza? Could he have praised him and say, you know, great job, American president, for doing that? When he becomes a critic, he'd have a lot more credibility. But we hear silence, and then we hear criticism. And now he's criticizing President Trump in Algeria today. Is that necessary?
News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way on a very busy Thursday. 1-866-408-7669. Joining us this hour, Seth Barron brings us from the New York Post editorial board, brings us his brand new book. It's out shortly, Weaponized: The Left's Capture and Destruction of America's Sacred Institutions. And we're seeing that. I mean, you don't have to look much further than the mayor here in New York, the radical leftist, a future squad member if she wins. In New Jersey, and you saw what happened with the mayor's race in Seattle, what almost happened in Minneapolis. So the Democratic Party has accepted socialists and Islamists. Good luck with that. Dennis Ross standing by to bring us inside the latest news from the Middle East as the ceasefire continues tenuously. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I don't think that the message of the gospel is meant to be abused in the way that some people are doing. And I will continue to speak out loudly against war, looking to promote peace.
That is Pope Leo taking on the president. The president taking on Pope Leo. We'll see where this goes.
Number two.
I'm perfectly happy to have people change the world, you know, and do amazing stuff and be rich. They have to be good members of this community and pay their taxes. And I'm a billionaire who wants them to pay much more taxes.
He's spending more money in the governor's race than ever before in history, and he might just win the nomination. Tom Steyer, that nobody in the Democratic Party likes, but it looks like nobody else is stepping forward. Come on, Steve Hilton.
Number one.
Our troops are highly motivated, they're focused, they're vigilant, and they're ready. And they're using this time to do a couple of things. We're rearming. We're retooling and we're adjusting our tactics, techniques, and procedures. There's no military in the world that adjusts like we do, and that's exactly what we're doing right now.
And that's how Admiral Brad Cooper is making the most of the 10-day ceasefire, ready to fight. Trump sends in more troops, and they make it clear the blockade is staying around, and would it be effective? Joining us now, Ambassador Dennis Ross. Dennis, do you like the idea of the blockade?
I do like it. You know, Brian, early on, I didn't like the fact that we were allowing the Iranians to sell their oil when no one else could. And I feel the blockade is important for two reasons. Number one, it's a counterpoint to their closing the straits. It's a strategic lever for them that they've never had. We need to have a counterpoint to it. The blockade is that. Number two, the blockade really will shrink the revenues that they have available. It'll put much more of a squeeze on them than almost anything else we're doing. And you can do it in a way that is just completely justified because they broke international law by blocking and controlling an international waterway. Again, think about this. The Suez Canal and the Panama Canal are man-made canals that were built within sovereign states. So that's why you can charge tolls. This is an international waterway under no one's sovereignty. And for Iran suddenly to decide that they will control a choke point that effectively cuts off 20% of the world's oil and natural gas, 33% of the fertilizers, a significant amount of helium, which goes into semiconductors. This is an effect on the global economy. It is illegal, and we certainly have the right to counteract it, and that's what we're doing, so I'm definitely in favor of it.
Here's more on how we're doing it. General Kane, cut one.
This blockade applies to all ships, regardless of nationality, heading into or from Iranian ports. The U.S. action is a blockade of Iran's ports and coastline, not a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. Enforcement will occur inside Iran's territorial seas and in international waters.
So far, they've 10 vessels have been turned away since Monday. Some say as many as 15, including Iranian vessels, and China can't get through.
Right. that puts enormous amount of pressure on China. 50% of all of their oil comes from the Gulf. So this is not something they can withstand for a long time. It is true, just so to be fair, they have built up an enormous reserve. They have a reserve of at least 4 months. So they could tolerate this for a while. But the truth is they don't have a reserve because they want to use it. They want the reserve there always as a kind of insurance policy. They don't want to have to be drawing down on it. There is a question. When we do this, you can't say it has no risk. It does have some risk. The Iranians can choose to basically go after their neighbors. You can say, if we can't be importing, exporting, you can't. That's a distinct possibility. They could decide also to try to hit some of the high-value energy-related targets. There is a danger there. But we're in a situation where they were exerting all the leverage. They had way too much confidence because we were allowing them to sell their oil. We were sending the message to them how important this was to us to keep the price low. It made them think they had an enormous card. And then for the first time in 47 years, they were controlling the Straits of Hormuz. They never had that before, and they never tried to do it before because they understood the risk of doing it. They understood it would produce a war, right? They were in a war, and that's why they decided to act on this. It will not be easy to get them to give this up, even if we end up doing a deal that has some kind of international regime that they will say they're a part of. I can almost promise you, from time to time, suddenly they'll raise questions, or they'll block certain ships. They'll single out certain countries. That and who's going to go to war over every time they do that to a single ship? So we have to be quite mindful when we come out of this. They're still going to play games with it.
So Miad Mialaki is with the Foundation of Democracies. He they had a similar idea that you did. Once the violence stops, cut 10.
I think in a matter of 2 months, we're going to see a regime really reaching the point of not being able to pay salaries and riots and defections within the regime.
I mean, inflation's at 140%. They're losing $450 million, a ridiculous amount every a day. And they've been unable to, and to rebuild, they say it's going to cost $270 billion. So do you think once the deal is reached, Iran is still in trouble?
I do think they are in trouble, although I think, look, they're going to get a bit of an economic lifeline. It's pretty clear. I mean, we're offering the lifting of sanctions. Now, the truth is, there's a limit to how much the president can lift sanctions because there are legislatively mandated sanctions on human rights, on terror, on money laundering. And those have to be lifted only by the Congress. The president can do certain things through executive order, but there's a limitation here. What he can do through executive order, and obviously allowing them to sell their oil, is a lifting of an important sanction. They will have more means to deal with the nature of their problems when this is over, but the fundamental contradictions of this regime are still going to be there. And think about the following. The hardliners who, especially in the Revolutionary Guard right now, Ahmed Vafidi, who basically want to maintain the policies of the past and are resisting even doing a deal now, the fact is, in the past, they could make their recommendations, but it was the supreme leader who would make the decisions. These guys never had responsibility. Now think about, even if there's more money coming in, the nature of their problems, what they have to rebuild, the grievances that are deeply set within the public right now, they're going to have to make some choices. And as they make those choices, it's not going to necessarily allow them to manage what is basically a deep-seated, alienated public. My own feeling is we won't see this immediately, but I think within a year, we will see the emergence of, say, what I call an Iranian Gorbachev, someone who will say, we have to reform this system in order to save it. We have to focus on domestic. We have to end our confrontation with the rest of the world. Will that Iranian Gorbachev be able to emerge within a year? I think there's a distinct possibility that could take place.
So, Dennis, do you think that would you like to see the ceasefire extended? Do you want to see a second phase of talks? What do you think is the best outcome?
Hello?
Can you hear me? Okay, we're going to try to get him right back up. So I think there's a lot of people who have different feelings. Listen, it's inevitable that we're going to fight. We can never trust them. They want to extend the talks, just end it. So, Ambassador, I'll ask you again. Do you like to see a second phase of talks or the ceasefire to end in 10 days, which will be Tuesday?
If we get what we need out of this, it would be great to get the ceasefire to, you know, to produce an agreement. I'm not sure we're going to get what we need. I think the Iranians still think that they can hold out for more. They think that they can endure pain more than we can. I think there may be a second round in exchanges, and then another set, and then another ceasefire. I do think there is. Both sides clearly want this to end. The best proof of it on their side, notwithstanding what I was just saying, is that Ghalibaf said there will be no direct talks unless the frozen assets are unfrozen and unless there's a ceasefire in Lebanon. Neither one of those happened, and they talked. So that tells me they want it over. It's pretty clear to me that the president would like to see it over.
I mean, definitely paying a political price because of the economic price. But he's doing it in April, not in November. So there'll be plenty of time for that oil and gas to come down. But the rest of the world, like India, like China, like Japan and South Korea, they're really struggling right now. And I hear there's gas lines in China.
Look, I think, as I was saying about China, notwithstanding the reserves that they've built up, that may be as much as 4 months' worth, when 50% of your oil comes from one place and suddenly that's not available, that has to affect you. And they do have leverage on the Iranians. So what I would have liked to have seen is I would have liked to have seen the president go quietly to Xi and just sort of say, look, if these guys think they can continue to control the Strait of Hormuz, I'm telling you that will not be the case. This is going to come to an end. And the only choices we have are either we take Karg Island or we do a blockade. Either way, that's bad for China. So it's really in your interest to figure out a way to put the right kind of pressure on Iran so they will understand this has to come to an end, including their control over the straits.
They did get a letter back and forth, and they think they have an understanding, and they're still supposed to have a meeting in May. How do you feel about NATO's stance on this? Don't use the base in Italy. Don't use the airspace in Spain. Limitations from France. Your reaction to NATO's response?
Well, look, I understand from the standpoint of many of our allies in Europe that they weren't consulted in advance. Their interests were affected by this. Many times they were berated by people in the administration, aside from the president. So I understand the reaction at one level. On the other hand, I would say in the end, this serves their interests as much as anybody's. They have a need. And the truth is, it isn't enough for them to be planning to organize what will be a kind of flotilla for managing the straits after the war is over. They should be helping now. It's in their interest to help now. You know, by the way, if they were helping, it also demonstrates a higher degree of isolation of Iran. Isolation of Iran has always been significant to the Iranians. When the NATO allies don't join us at this point, they're sending a signal that Iran is succeeding in driving wedges. That reduces the image of isolation. So I would like them to be thinking a little bit more strategically.
That would help, absolutely. I understand the element of surprise prevented the president from fully briefing everyone, especially he's got a lot of enemies in these Western countries. But for now on, going forward, I just don't get it. Ambassador Dennis Ross, thanks so much. Always great.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Brian.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. When we come back, I'll be able to get some of your calls. Almost every line is jammed. We'll discuss that, what's happening in California, and also the pontiff versus the president.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
President Trump, I think you should just understand that popes are going to be popes, and they're going to say that war is almost always bad. Pope Theo understands that most wars are bad, and I think President Trump has to understand. He should just say, I agree with you. Afghanistan was not a very good thing. Iraq was not a very good thing. And I'm only doing this because I have special knowledge that this was an imminent threat to the United States and its allies. Instead of getting into, oh no, you don't know what you're talking about, Pope Leo. That's not healthy. That's not helpful. It's not helpful to Trump.
Well, I know what you mean, because you don't want to alienate a billion Catholics, but you do have a Catholic pope who went at the president again, called him basically a tyrant about an hour ago, and 2 hours ago put out a statement talking about how war, all they care about is destruction. They don't use money to rebuild. Are you insane? Have you heard of the Marshall Plan? And there's sometimes there's a just war, and you could be the biblical scholar, and I'll tell you that I'm pretty glad there was an allied power to take on the Axis power. I'm pretty glad that in Afghanistan, where Al-Qaeda is, I'm pretty glad we went in there and forced them out. I don't love the way it was conducted, but you know what we did? We educated a generation of Afghanis, including women. You know what we also did? Rebuilt a lot of their cities. If they choose to wreck them, that's on us. That's on them. And now you have a pope that condemned our actions in Venezuela. Do you talk about the people that have been political prisoners that have been freed? Do you talk about the people that aren't dead because of that? The TDA that came to our country and killed Americans and created havoc? What about the drug trafficking? Does that matter at all? Or do you just stay in that lane and say, well, this is bad, this is good? If you're going to get into politics, you can't just say, well, this is how I feel, but I'm the pope. Don't say anything. In my view, and that's Father Jonathan, who left the priesthood, but is still a biblical scholar. And he said, I understand what you're saying, but you really shouldn't say anything. The Pope also went at our country about immigration, too. And Tom Homan came back at him. Here's what Tom Homan said. Cut 38.
Look, I'm not going to speak for the president. I'm speaking for myself, a lifelong Catholic. I wish they stay out of immigration. They don't know what they're talking about. Because if they wore my shoes for 40 years and talked to a 9-year-old girl that got raped multiple times, or stood in the back of a trailer, back tractor trailer, 19 dead aliens at my feet, including a 5-year-old boy that baked to death, if they understood the atrocities that happened on the open border, I think their opinion would change. And I welcome a discussion with any of them, because they don't understand.
100% true. All right, let's change gears. Barry, you're in Los Angeles. Hey, Barry.
Yeah, I'm getting sick of this thing that, oh, NATO wasn't warned ahead of time with the attack.
Yep.
For over 2 weeks, we had like 75% of our Navy.
I know.
Right next to Iran. Are these people really that stupid? And let's not forget NATO, like at least half of the countries were buying oil and natural gas from Russia 3 years into the Ukraine war.
I know.
Something needs to be done.
I know. Look, and the true colors are coming out, too. I mean, their disdain for us is pretty apparent. Now they're meeting without us, Barry, and to decide what's going to happen after the war's over, how they're going to keep the strait open without us. And it's America that's messing with NATO? Really?
So, I mean, but again, this excuse that they weren't warned ahead of time is just asinine. It's like nobody knew, like 3/4 of our Navy was right next to Iran. Come on.
I interviewed the former head of NATO, the Secretary General today, Jan Stoltenberg. I put it on my the exchange on X and on Instagram. So hopefully you'll check it out, because I basically put that on him. He's defending NATO. And their decision not to let us use our own bases. Our own bases. So we're supposed to protect you in Italy because you have no army. We're supposed to protect you in Spain because we've paid 1.2% on your military. But you won't let us use our own bases and your airspace. And it's Trump's at the problem? Don't think so. All right, we come back. Seth Barron joins us from the New York Post. We'll talk about the craziness, which is New York, our leadership, and everything else.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
New York City, it is time for a grand experiment once again. Just as LaGuardia used government to respond to the challenges of the Great Depression, we will use government to respond to rising prices and unaffordable groceries. Between 2013 and 2023, grocery prices increased in New York City by nearly 66%, significantly higher than the national average. During our campaign, we promised New Yorkers that we would create a network of city-owned grocery stores, one in each borough. And we are here today to celebrate the site of the Manhattan store, La Marqueta, which will be open by 2029.
2029. It is, check the calendar, 2026. 3 years to open a supermarket, which they admit will only decrease prices marginally if they get it up and running, let alone if it's going to be a unionized workplace. This is the magic of 34-year-old Mayor Mamdani in New York City. Seth Baron joins us now, New York Post editorial board and author of a brand new book, The Weapon is Weaponized, The Left's Capture and Destruction of America's Sacred Institutions. How about that $30 million supermarket?
Seems a little pricey to me, Brian. I'm not sure. Unless he's planning to outfit it with, you know, like an Erewhon.
For 3 years.
$25 strawberries. Yeah, 3 years. Notice it's going to open right when he's getting when he's running for reelection. It's a ridiculous project.
We could open up a supermarket in 6 weeks. John Casamatidis runs WABC. 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Why is he bragging about 3 years? How's he getting away with this?
I don't know. I don't really understand what it makes sense. And the other thing is, look, supermarket, the grocery business is incredibly competitive.
Yes.
And incredibly thin margins. There's nobody's like making millions off of supermarkets or bleeding the people dry with, you know, selling them eggs and apples and whatnot. I think this is a disaster waiting to happen. It's going to be, you know, extremely comical. The thing is, he says, well, it's going to be cheaper on a basket of staples, like milk, I guess, and bread. But, okay, that's called loss leading. Every store does that, makes certain things cheaper. And stores already lose money on milk and
bread. But he would have no idea. He's got not a capitalist cell in his body. Here's more, cut 55. The question came up from the media.
Why is it taking so long? I feel like a bodega opens every other week across New York City in every neighborhood.
Well, I think for a few reasons. The first is that we are talking about building something from the ground up. We're talking about this first city-run grocery store in Manhattan that we need to both design, that we also need to construct. We're also going to be constructing it using prevailing wages. And it's also one part of a larger ecosystem, not just in terms of La Marqueta, but also here on this strip. We've seen the MTA has just completed their work in this very area. This requires a lot of interagency and intergovernmental coordination that we're going to be seeing.
What's he talking about?
I mean, look, why not build it in the air?
Yeah.
That would cost a lot more money and take a lot more time. And it would be, you know, you could really hire a lot of people to do it. I mean, why not just buy an existing closed
building? Absolutely.
I don't understand the virtue of building it from scratch. Like, what is he doing? Except just, you know, it's a jobs program.
Right. So when you look at what's happening in New York City, he's got 48% approval rating. A lot of socialists are looking around the country saying, I'd like to be like Mamdani. You had 60% approval rating for Eric Adams at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you say to that?
I mean, I think he has a deep fan. He has a very powerful fan base, which is small, but they're very vocal. And he just keeps pumping out his social media videos and talking about soaking the rich.
Yesterday, did that?
Yes. You know, we're going to tax the rich. And the funny thing about his taxes, he says, and the people he talked to said, it's not about raising revenue. It's about seizing power. It's about taking power from, you know, people who work hard, who are successful, and transferring it to the government. They don't want power residing outside of you know, their network.
Right. Good luck with that. He says, I'm going to tax. Get this. If you have a home, a second home worth more than $5 million, we're going to up your taxes. Let me see, Seth Baron. Is there a problem with that concept? Maybe I don't want that second home if you're going to up my taxes. And those are the types of people you cultivate. You don't alienate.
They are dedicated to the idea of soaking the rich, anybody who has money in New York. And they love this idea that none of these people can leave because New York City, New York State are just so attractive that they can basically rake everybody over the coals, because who would leave such a place?
Right. So I want you to hear probably the most disturbing sentence. And people have heard me play this a few times on the show. But this is Mamdani talking about his 100 days and what he's so proud of. Cut 56.
That is the change that government can deliver. And it is the change that democratic socialism can deliver. I know there are many who use socialist as a dirty word, something to be ashamed of.
They can try all they want, but we will not be ashamed of using government to fight for the many, not simply the few.
He's proud. That used to be a label, a scarlet letter. Now he embraces it.
Look, New York State's budget and New York City's budget have gone up like, I don't know, 30% in the last 10 years. But the population hasn't changed. What are they? And it's gone up well past the rate of inflation. So what are they doing with all this money except just expanding government, you know, hiring new people, raising, you know, pensions? I mean, I guess this is socialism, just expanding the government.
I guess. And part of that is what's happening in the 11th district today, where you have a woman running for office for Mikey Sherrill's governor spot. It's 11th district, who is to the left of AOC.
Mm-hmm.
And is up by about 3 points over Joe Hathaway, the moderate Republican in the polls, over an area which was considered center-right.
Yes.
Mejia.
Listen, I don't know what's going on in this country. I don't know why people are voting to have themselves strapped and whipped by the hard left, especially in neighborhoods like, you know, Montclair. I mean, that's what we're talking about, right? Like middle-class, upper-middle-class New Jersey suburbs. These people appear to be insane, I guess. I don't know why else they would be doing this to themselves.
Right. So you have Hathaway, who was a councilman, he was a mayor, and now he's running as a Republican, and we're probably going to get a rematch right away in November. But in the meantime, that's a seat that I'm sure Mike Johnson would love to have, but I don't see anybody with him in front. And now you're going to have another radical lefty who hates Israel. Who will look to raise minimum wage to $25, which might be good unless you're a business owner, and then also look to abolish ICE. And she's also in the past talked about abolishing the police.
Sure. Well, this is the program. This is the program we've got in the Democrat Party. I mean, some of them are resisting it a little bit, like Fetterman. But
that's about it.
That's pretty much it.
That's it. But so tell me about your book, Weaponized. What do you mean they're taking over the institutions?
Well, what I look at is four key institutions in America. I look at citizenship. I look at education, policing, and housing. And the idea is that the left has infested each of these institutions and perverted their original intention to do what we were talking about before, which is take power from local communities and raise it up to unelected people like Randy Weingarten in the teachers' union, people who are like YIMBYs, people who want to destroy local zoning, to defund the police contingent, the open borders contingent. And, you know, so I basically dig into each of these areas and examine the ways in which the last 10 or 15 years or longer, the left has really promoted this, what they call the long march through the institutions.
So if you look at the pushback that Trump's leading on education, when you look at the pushback we're doing now with sealing the border, pushing back to the point it's almost controversial, how many people we're looking to deport, is that a pushback in this weaponization? And are Republicans slow to realize this?
Republicans are very slow to realize this. I talk about this in the book. You know, there's this old saying, you may not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you. Well, Republicans always think, conservatives think, well, you know, I don't really care. I'm doing my own thing. But Democrats love the idea of politics being interested in them because they find themselves so fascinating. Mm-hmm. So to them, this is their mission, is just to not to necessarily focus on raising families or making money, whatever. Their mission is minding someone else's business.
Right. And do you think outside forces are doing this? I mean, when I look at the protests that are taking place, these are not organic protests about Americans protesting like they used to with the Vietnam War or civil rights in the 60s. You didn't need outside forces there. You had people who said there's an inequity in this state, in this city, in this school district, and we're standing up for it. We don't want the war, and we're not going to go. I get it. But I'm seeing these pro-Iranian, pro-Hamas protests. Where does that come from?
Well, you know, people have looked into this. It does seem like there's outside agents. It could be China with their support for the People's Forum and Code Pink. It could be coming from Russia. I don't know. But it definitely seems like there's some kind of foreign influence going
on. Right. So, Seth, when's the book coming out?
Book will be out April 28th.
All right. Called Weaponized, The Left's Capture and Destruction of America's Sacred Institution. Seth Baron of the New York Post. Thanks so much, Seth.
Thank you so much, Brian.
All right, back in a moment. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
From breaking news to big-name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Hey everyone, so I'm here in Charlotte. Since the start of Trump's war of choice, it's $15 more every time you fill up your tank of gas. The price of diesel has now gone up 80% since the start of the war. And you best believe that's going to carry over to how much you're paying for all the goods that are being transported on those semis. We've got a president who is paying more attention to what he thinks is in his best political interest and personal interest as opposed to what is in the best interest of working people in America.
Right. You have a woman as vice president, clueless, still thinks she's a legitimate contender to be the next president, Kamala Harris. You realize gas is still basically lower than it was when you were president and vice president and Joe Biden was in office and you refused to drill, refused to seal the border. But you go ahead, guys, Al Sharpton, everyone, tell me that Kamala Harris will be your nominee. It's good news for the world. Here's some good news, legitimate good news, not sarcastic good news. President Trump just put this on Truth Social. I just had an excellent conversation with the president, Joseph Aoun of Lebanon, and Prime Minister Netanyahu. These two leaders have agreed to a 10-day ceasefire, and I'll just be they're gonna firm it up. It'll start 5 o'clock. A 10-day ceasefire. Why is that important? Hezbollah is like a cancer inside Lebanon. Lebanon was never a problem. Never had a problem with Israel. It's Hezbollah who's taken over large swaths of Lebanon, who's become a political organization along with a military organization, the most well-armed and rehearsed terrorist group in the world. There's a 10-day ceasefire. The question is, if Hezbollah starts breaking that ceasefire, what does Israel do? They hit him right back, no doubt about it. But what the president's trying to say is, look, Lebanon and Israel have no problems. Let Israel get rid of that cancer for you. Let it be the chemotherapy that Lebanon needs. And then when it's all said and done, you'll be in control of your country again. And then maybe you'll sign on to the Abraham Accords. Dave, you're in Florida. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Brian. Good to be on the show. I have a question for you. A lot of my coworkers, friends, we all have the same question. I'm assuming that a lot of America has the same question. It was even brought up on Hannity yesterday, and he couldn't really answer it. So I fully support Trump, and he's told us that we are energy independent, correct? All the oil coming out of the Straits of Hormuz, 90% of that goes to China. We don't even rely on that. So if that's the case and we're energy independent, why is this affecting our gas prices?
Just because it's a global commodity. They look at, for some reason, they look at it as a global price. So, for example, when Joe Biden refused to pump here, right, he just wanted to drain the reserves and ask Saudi Arabia to pick up the pace. President Trump says, I'm just going to pick up the pace, see if we have to. I'm going to push everybody to drill. And that'll force the global price down along with our price. Saudis cut back. That drives the price up along with their own prices, although it's basically they're paying basically a nickel per gallon over in Saudi Arabia. So they told me, the oil experts, it's too hard to have just a North American price and a American price for oil and gas, that we need to sell some of it in different kinds to other countries. And because of that, it's always been a global commodity. That's the way it's always been explained to me. Now, no one's even asked that until the last 5-6 years. Why? Because for the first time, we are the number one oil and gas producers in the world. So now, instead of saying like it was in the 70s when I was in grammar school, teachers used to not be able to get to school on time or come in tears because they were running out of gas while waiting for gas in lines, that'll never happen again. But it's happening in Japan. It's happening in China. It's happening in India because they don't produce their own. What they're trying to do is take that global price and have people fill up, literally fill up their tankers. 130 different super tankers are heading our direction because of that. But listen to Scott Bessent talk about where we're going to be at, in his mind, where we're going to be at with the price of gas. Cut five.
I think we're going to have to wait and see when they are permanently open, because this is a mechanism. When we declare that it is safe, they also have to have insurance. Lloyd's of London had skyrocketing insurance during the time. The rates are still very high. So we want to provide, the U.S. government will make a profit on this, but we want to provide a more normalized level and an economically sound basis for ships to move in and out of the Gulf as they did before the start of the conflict.
And fundamentally, we couldn't talk about regime change, but it would be great to give the people of Iran regime change. There was two more executions today. There were up over 1,570 executions in Iran. That's that's high for even them, that horrible regime, a high since 1989. Here's Dr. Sheila Nazarene, who escaped Iran during the Islamic Revolution and talked last night about what she left behind. Cut nine.
Iran has been at the top of the executions list per capita year over year over year for a very long time. They use public executions to intimidate any kind of people that want to go against the regime. They use it to traumatize the people. And, you know, these public executions are being ramped up because the government is becoming paranoid and threatened, and they want to basically quash any dissent, and they use these public executions with fake crimes, like, you know, a crime against God, and then they will torture, rape these women, because in their twisted minds they believe a virgin that is killed goes to heaven. So to prevent any of these women from going to heaven, they gang rape them before they kill them.
That's how horrible this regime is. But yet most Democrats say a war of choice, that we didn't have to go into, and President Trump doesn't know what he's doing, 25th Amendment, listen to his comments, as if this hasn't been an enemy of everyone. In fact, Kamala Harris, of all people, was asked in 2024, the number one enemy of America, says Iran. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Make sure you watch One Nation Sunday at 10 o'clock. And go to BrianKilmeade.com for history, liberty, and laughs. May 30th in Reno, in Pensacola, Florida, July 11th, and Jacksonville, Clearwater, and more in the fall.